Our attitude toward Jesus' return, Matthew 24:44, was presented by Ron Julian on November 11, 2001, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I thought, let's take a minute to pray before I start talking. Father, we have come together this morning because we enjoy being together with each other, but mostly we have come together because in one way or another we are all trying to understand better who you are and what it means to follow you. We ask that you would have mercy on us and teach us what we need to know. Give us understanding, give us courage. Give us the courage to look at ourselves and know ourselves the way we ought to, and give us the courage to look at the world around us and see it in the light of your promises. We need to understand you and what you intend for our lives. And we're very grateful that you have not left us to ourselves, but have reached out to us to do that very thing. Okay. I just probably should warn you this morning. Every now and again, I get into a phase of tiredness where my brain is just not working. And unfortunately, this morning, it's just been that way. I find myself staring into space, forgetting what it is that I was just about to do and that sort of thing. And that's always a bad sign for you when I'm going to be talking. So if along the way, you know, you're trying to put together, I'm sure there's a thought in there somewhere, but it's not quite coming out. I really invite you at the end to ask me, Ron, could you just like explain what it is you just said? That would be fine. The sort of world-shaking events, like those of September 11th, are the kind that usually get Christians thinking about the return of Christ and the end of the world. I know it has that effect on me. When I read in the news what's happening, I look at the way Israel seems to find its way into center stage as an issue for the politics of the world and the massing of armies and so on. It's hard not to think of the prophets and what they had to say about the final battle and all of that. Unfortunately, we as Christians have a reputation for seeing signs of Jesus' return in every event that happens around us, just about. You may remember, it was very striking to me, that during the Gulf War, there was such a demand for books about Saddam Hussein and his connection with Armageddon that the bookstores couldn't keep them on the shelves. I mean, there was just this huge run on books, anything having to do with Iraq. And skeptics, rightly enough, I think, point out that Christians have responded in the same way in the past to Napoleon and Lenin and Hitler and Henry Kissinger and maybe Britney Spears. I mean, who knows? We have what seems to me to be a 100% failure rate. We have never been right about any of that. And so others of us have responded to that picture by deciding that it is foolish to concern ourselves with the second coming at all, and any sort of concern with the signs of the times would be seen as naive and pointless and just not really what a person ought to be doing. So the question I want to explore a little bit this morning is, what sort of attitude should we have toward the events that will lead up to the return of Christ? In the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said, "Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming." But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. What does Jesus mean by this? I mean, he's telling us to be on the alert. What does that look like? What does a life lived on the alert, in the light of what Jesus says here, look like? What are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to buy every book on... I mean, I assume the bookstores will soon have books explaining the connection between Osama bin Laden and Armageddon. Are we supposed to rush out and buy those books too? Or what does it look like to be people who are on the alert, looking for Christ's coming in the way he describes? That's what I want to talk about this morning. And I'm going to be bouncing around a little bit between two passages, the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and Paul's teaching in 1 Thessalonians 5. It's not my purpose this morning to really explain the teaching of the Olivet Discourse. I have taught on that in the past, although I guess it's been a number of years ago since I did that. Maybe sometime I'll do that again. But today I just want to explore the specific question of what does Jesus mean for us to be on the alert? Should we take that to heart? Is there something we are not doing that we should be doing? What does it look like? Okay, so what does it mean then to be on the alert? What is he talking about? It seems to me that the basic metaphor behind his teaching here is, as we saw in the passage I read, this idea that he is going to return like a thief in the night. The whole point is that thieves do not announce that they are coming. The homeowner goes to bed assuming that tonight will be like any other night. But the problem is that he's wrong. Tonight, when he's asleep, there is someone that's going to sneak into his house and steal all his stuff. If the homeowner had known that the thief was coming, then he would have been ready. He would have been sitting up. The doors would have been locked better. The windows would have been locked, and he would have been waiting there, you know, with a baseball bat or whatever, or with the police. Who knows? But the thing is that he didn't know. He didn't expect that tonight, this night, this thief was going to break into the house. And he went to bed with what turned out to be a naive assumption that things were just going to go on the way they had always been, that tonight was going to be just like the night before and the night before. Jesus seems to be saying that his return is going to catch the world by surprise, that it's going to be like that thief in the night, that people are not going to be prepared for. So we certainly see that his proclamation of his return, he's saying that it's different than as if he had said, well, okay, I'm going to be gone for 2,000 years, and on this date, be waiting up at the top of the hill because I'll be coming down. It's not like that. He says the way it's going to happen is when I return, people are not going to be expecting it. He also, though, seems to be suggesting that we as his followers should not be taken by surprise. Although he's coming as a thief in the night, there's this sense in which we as his followers ought to be prepared, be on the ready, be on the alert. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, Paul, I think, borrows Jesus' language to say very much the same thing. He says, "Now as to the times and the epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you. For you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. While they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like birth pangs upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day should overtake you like a thief, for you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So then, let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober." The world around us will be saying peace and safety, and then the day of the Lord will come upon them unexpectedly, and it will not be good news when it arrives. But we, Paul says, will not be caught unawares by that day because we are not asleep. We are following his command to be alert and sober. So I return to my question then. What does it mean to be alert? What are they getting at? I think Jesus illustrates it perfectly in the Olivet Discourse with a parable that he tells. And let me start with verse 44. This is in Matthew 24. There are different versions in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I'm in Matthew 24:44. For this reason you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour which he does not know, and shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and the gnashing of teeth. In this parable, we have a picture of two servants, one who is ready for his master's return and one who is not. Now, I think one of the striking things as we're trying to understand what Jesus means about being alert, being ready for his return, is that in this story, neither of the servants knows when the master is returning. It is not in the story that one of them is not paying attention to the signs, but the other one is looking every day and says, I think this is the day he's coming. I'd better get myself ready. It's not like that. Both of them are taken by surprise in the sense that they did not expect the master on the day he arrived. They didn't know when he was going to arrive. But one servant let the master's absence lull him into thinking that he need not pay attention to what the master wanted him to do. Oh, he's gone. He's not here. I don't have to worry about him. He's going to be a long time coming. I mean, I don't have to worry about that for a long time. Right now, I can do what I want. And as it says, he basically ignored what the master had told him to do. He didn't take care of the other servants, the household, the way he was supposed to, but he abused his position, and he got drunk, and he abused the other servants, and basically did what he wanted. For him, the master's return catches him off guard. Maybe if he had not been thinking, oh, that's going to be a long time in the future, he might have decided, maybe I need to stop and think about, someday my master's going to come back, and I'm going to have to answer to him, and maybe I had better stop and think about what I'm doing right now. To him, the return of the master is a theoretical sort of thing. Okay, yeah, he's going to come back, but that's a long time away. I don't have to really think about that. The other servant is ready and prepared, is not caught off guard, even though he's surprised. I mean, we know he didn't know when the master was coming back, but he's not caught off guard because he expects it, because he knows that the master is going to return and he's going to have to give an account of the way he conducted himself. He lives every day knowing that the master left him with a job to do. So it doesn't really matter which day the master comes back, because he's ready on any day. He's doing what he was charged with doing. He is living his life, conducting himself as a servant, in the knowledge that he has been given a task to do and his master is going to return and he's going to have to answer for it. So the master's return does not overtake him like a thief in the night. He didn't know when it was going to happen, but he knew that it was going to happen, and he lived in the light of that knowledge. It seems to me that that is the picture that Jesus is painting of what it means to be a person who is on the alert. You don't know when I'm coming back, so be prepared. And being prepared means not figuring out when Jesus is coming back, not having known in advance before he got here, when it was that he was going to arrive, but it is to remember that he is coming back and living in the light of his coming. Being on the alert means remembering at all times that I am a servant of Christ, the Christ who really is King and Master, the one who really is coming back, the one who really will be my judge and my Savior. That's, I think, the picture that Jesus paints of what it means to be on the alert. As I say, not figuring out in advance when it happens, but being prepared for it whenever it happens. So what does it look like then to be a person who is on the alert? Well, there are a couple of things we could look at here. One of them, the parable we just talked about, notice in the parable the master has set a task for the servant to do. He has asked him to obey him and to follow his commands. And in the story, his commands have to do with feeding the household, feeding the rest of the servants, being concerned for the running of the household and make sure that the other servants are being fed at the proper time. That's the job that he was given. And I think at this point that Jesus chose that particular task because there is an analogy that he wants to draw. I think it's helpful to remember that first of all, primarily, the Olivet Discourse was Jesus teaching to his disciples right then. Much of what Jesus had to say about the future was aimed at his disciples because he was trying to tell them, you know, it's not like you think. It's not like in a couple of days I'm going to be crowned as the Messiah and the kingdom of God is going to be inaugurated and we're all just going to enter into paradise. The fact is, I'm going away. And when I go away, I'm leaving you with a job to do. There's much of Jesus' teaching that is focused on getting it across to his disciples. I'm leaving, and I'm leaving you to continue the task that I have started. And so I think that idea of being left as a servant with the job of feeding the other servants, I think it directly relates to the situation that the disciples faced. Jesus is in that picture painting what their situation is going to be. He's leaving them with the task of taking care of his household, of teaching the truth, of reminding people what the gospel is. So feeding the household there, I think, is an analogy for the work of proclaiming the gospel, the work of the ministry, basically. Now, that analogy doesn't just apply to the original disciples, though, because all of us are left as followers of Christ with a certain subset of that responsibility of being concerned for each other and, in general, to be obedient to what God has called us to do. So, what it looks like to be a person who is living awake, alert, ready for the return of Christ is to be a person who is in obedience to him doing what he has called us to do. Primarily the task of calling each other to believe the gospel and live in the light of the gospel, but then ultimately anything else that God has called us to do. That's what living a life that is alert looks like. I think Paul has a similar sort of idea in the 1 Thessalonians passage. He says, as I read, that we are not in darkness, that the day should overtake you like a thief, for you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. Okay, so he's running this metaphor here. I hope it's apparent to you as he's saying that he's not literally concerned just about sleeping and drunkenness. He's using this as a metaphor. There are those who are in the dark. They're in the night. They're walking around without the light. They don't realize what's going on. And what do you do at nighttime when it's dark? You get drunk or you go to sleep. But if you're of the day, the light is shining. You can see what's going on. So the daytime is not the time to be asleep. It is the time to be awake and to be sober, to attend to the day's business. That's the picture that he's painting, is that those who have heard what God has promised and responded to it are in the situation where they're in touch with what's really going on and are awake. They're aware of, for their own sake, they know that Jesus is coming back, that there are promises that he is going to fulfill, that he is going to judge the nations, that my destiny depends on my standing ultimately with him. So that's what it means to be awake. And then he describes it perfectly. Since we are of the day, let us be sober. We're going to be sober and awake. And what does that look like? He describes it. Having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. You may recognize this is a phrase that Paul uses in important passages. What is it that is at the heart of what it means to be a believer in this life? What are our lives about now? Faith, hope, and love. That's what he says in the famous 1 Corinthians 13 passage where he talks about love. And here we have those three again. What does it mean to be sober, to be walking in the light, to be awake and alert so that the day will not overtake you like a thief? Put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. To be awake and alert now means to live a life of faith, believing in God and his promises. It means to live a life of love, seeking to love God and to love my neighbor as myself. And it means living a life with the hope of salvation. It means living in the light of where I'm headed, knowing that when Jesus returns to establish his kingdom, I will be rescued. That's the life that Paul is calling us to live. To believe, to love, and to have hope in the light of what we believe. That is to live a life that is sober and alert. And if I live a life like that, I will be prepared when Jesus comes. If I am not living a life like that, I will be unprepared, and the day will catch me like a thief in the night. But if I am living like that, I will be prepared. Okay, now, in the light of that, let me explore a couple of questions then that seem to me to be related. Should we as Christians be concerned with the return of Christ? Should we be preoccupied with the return of Christ? Well, in one sense, I would say yes, absolutely. The return of Christ should be our great preoccupation. I mean, this is one of the things that I think is fundamental. If I'm wrong about this idea, I'm wrong about pretty much everything I think about what Christianity is about. Because from beginning to end, I see the Bible and its message as being what theologians would call eschatological. It is focused on the end, what we think of as the end, the last things, which is really the beginning if you think about it. But from the beginning of the book, it's laying out the human situation as one that is fallen, that is corrupted. We need to be rescued from death. We need to be rescued from sin. We need to be rescued from futility. And God is in the process of doing that. Christianity is not just an ethical system. It is a proclamation that God exists and that he is doing a certain thing to bring about the rescue of the world, and that Jesus' return will be the inauguration and completion of that project so that all of creation will be finally restored. So, yes, in that sense, that's at the heart of what it means to be a believer, is that we believe that this is not the end of the story. What I'm doing now is significant, but it is significant ultimately in the light of where the story is headed. So I am saying something different than those who would say it's naive and foolish to be concerned with the second coming or to be thinking about when that would happen or anything like that. That's not true. It is true that I believe we should concentrate on the duties before us today as servants of Christ, like in those parables and like what Paul said. My task is to live a life of faith, hope, and love. My task is to follow God and try to be obedient to what it is that I have been called to do. But I am doing those tasks, I am living that light in the light of His coming. My faith is a faith that focuses on the promise of Christ's kingdom. My hope is the hope that one day I and all salvation will, all creation will enter into salvation. That's my hope. I choose to live a certain way today because I have a hope for the future. And I think that it's not an exaggeration. Peter just meant it flat out when he said, "Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ." That's where my hope needs to be fixed. That's the focus of my life. That's ultimately what you and I are trying to learn, is to put the focus of our lives where the focus belongs. So, yeah, I think we ought to be greatly concerned with the return of Christ, because that's what this is all about. But, on the other hand, watching, being alert, does not necessarily mean that I will have figured out when it is that Christ is returning. The admonition to be alert, to be aware, to be awake, is not an admonition to make sure that you have figured out all of the details and prophecies so that you know everything that's going to happen. It is an admonition to believe in the return of Christ, to put your hope in it, and live a life of faith, so that when Christ returns, you will be among those who enter into life. So let me ask another question then. Am I saying that we should not try to understand biblical prophecy and compare it with current events? No, I'm not saying that either. I have always been interested in those questions, off and on, throughout my life. But as I have commented many times, those of you who know me know that it's true that when I first became a Christian at the age of 18 in 1971, this was at the height of the popularity of a certain book. How many know the book before I say it? Yes, a lot of you do. The book is The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. And The Late Great Planet Earth was the first book that I read. I mean, the first book that I read after I became a Christian. I mean, like within days of I'm a new Christian and I read The Late Great Planet Earth. Well, For a time, I was just totally, maybe you could say derailed by it, I don't know, but I thought that was so cool. And I started, man, I could tell you, you know, so we're talking about chapter 2 and chapter 7 and chapter 9 in Daniel, and let's not forget Ezekiel 38 and 39, and, you know, Zechariah 12, that's a good one. You know, I knew all of, and boy, you, my Bible might as well have been one of those where you take and cut and paste things, because my Bible had about 20 verses in it, was all. You take and cut out the passages that have to do with Jesus coming back, and you take them and stir them together into a stew, and that's the Bible. That's about what it has to say. Well, I have always been grateful that somewhere along the line I read another book besides The Late Great Planet Earth, and finally figured out that maybe I was being a little naive about how to approach that stuff. And in the end, of course, I have never heard Hal Lindsey address this, but he sort of, at the end of that book, implies that he has a pretty good idea of how things are going to happen, and sort of hints, this is what's going to be happening. You watch, this is how it's going to turn out. And it didn't turn out that way, as far as I can tell. I've never really heard, has anyone ever heard him say anything about how it didn't turn out that way and why it is it didn't turn out that way? I haven't. One of the things I learned back then is that there is a danger in being preoccupied with the question of what is the Bible saying about the future, because the Bible has very few places, actually, if it has any, that that address the question of the future in the abstract separately from some other issue. The passages that we go to the prophets. We go to the book of Daniel, and we're concerned with the 70 weeks and the beast with 10 horns and all of that kind of stuff, and which is fine. I believe that the book of Daniel is an inspired work that belongs in the canon of the Bible, and I want to understand what it's saying. But one of the things that I've noticed of myself, and I'm just saying this of myself, is that what is the stuff that I have read the most in Daniel? It's chapter 2 with the statue of the head, and you know, and chapter 7, they've got the four beasts and the little horn comes up and all of that stuff, and chapter 9 with the 70 weeks and all of that. That's the kind of stuff that I've read in Daniel. And it's only been recently that I found myself thinking, well, all right, I am interested in what the Bible has to say about the future. But I remember what happened in my earlier days as a Christian when I was concerned about questions about what the Bible had to say about salvation, or what the Bible had to say about justification, or what the Bible had to say about the problem of sin and how does it work itself out in this life. And I remember that my first inclination was to go and grab passages and pull them out of context, and that I didn't get anywhere doing that. That in the end, I had to be patient and take on the book of Romans as a whole, and take on the book of Galatians as a whole. Try to understand the context. What is the issue? To whom is Paul writing? What I need to, in other words, back up and not force the text to try to answer my questions, but to let the text answer the questions that the author has on his mind. And so one of the things that I have been having to teach myself over the years, then, is to, if I'm going to be concerned with something like the book of Daniel and what it has to say about the future, I had better be concerned with the whole book of Daniel. And recently, it crossed my mind that the next time that I teach here, I don't have a series of things. I don't know if this is the case. I'm not making any promises. And this is either a promise or a threat, depending on whether you're interested in this or not. But I was thinking about maybe teaching the book of Daniel. But what occurred to me as I started to look at that is that I have never, to my embarrassment, I have never really sat down and worked through the book of Daniel from the beginning to try to see what is this book about. I mean, in the end, could I capture what is it that the book of Daniel is trying to get across? And I think that without doing that, pulling out those prophetic pieces has the potential of really misleading you. So my warning to us is, yeah, I think it's entirely appropriate for us to be interested in what the Bible has to say about the future. I'm interested in that question. But if we're going to be interested in that question, we have to take the long view, which means we have to be patient and try to take the Bible's message as a whole and make some progress in seeing, do I get the message of the book of Daniel so that I have some confidence that I'm not taking it and turning it into something that it wasn't intended to be? Am I even confident that the passages that I'm so inclined to go to say, here's what the future holds, am I sure that those passages are talking about my future? Because there are some passages that people would go to say, see, this is what's going to be happening in the future, that at this point in my study of the Bible, I would say, well, you know, I don't think so. I think that already happened, actually. That was something else that it was talking about. So I think we ought to be concerned with what God has revealed in His Word, which means we ought to be students of the Bible, which means as a part of that package, we ought to be growing in some sort of understanding of what God has said about the future. But let me just give you a report for myself personally, as one who has been interested in these questions, who has thought about these questions off and on for a number of years, but who has been trying to go back and be careful that I'm paying attention to the context and that I'm not forcing things on the passages. In my own journey to understand these things, I find that I now understand less than I used to, which is a good thing as far as I'm concerned. It seems to me that the questions involved here are very complicated. And there are a lot of decisions that have to be made. A lot of decisions that have to be made. And when you hear somebody say, well, this passage in the Olivet Discourse means that the Antichrist is going to do this, or this passage in Revelation means that there's going to be a millennium and it's going to be like so, or here's the church gets raptured here, or, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You just need to be aware that back behind those statements is a whole set of presuppositions about what prophetic literature is and how it needs to be approached. I'm not saying that nobody has ever gotten it right, but I am saying that if we're going to have confidence that we have understood it, we've got to back up a step and make sure that we're building on a solid foundation. I'm trying to do that for myself, make sure that I'm building on a solid foundation in my understanding of these things. And I have to say at this point that I have a few things that seem to me to be pretty solid, pretty clear. But much of it, you know, if I had to vote on those isms, you know, which camp do you fall into? You know, are you a pre-trib rap guy, or, you know, how does this stuff work? I could tell you, I could locate myself on the map, but I honestly have to tell you that it would not take much to push me from one of those spots into another one. Now, some of them are less likely at this point than others. Some of them just do not make sense to me, and I don't think I'm going there. But they all hinge on a number of choices that you have to make. How symbolic do we take the imagery to be in the book of Revelation? A very challenging book to understand. Do we understand the Olivet Discourse to be talking about fundamentally about something that is still to happen in the future, or is Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD? There's tons of questions like that, and each of those questions takes you down a certain road that cumulatively end up taking you in one direction or another. So I think, personally, it's crazy that we as Christians have put so much emphasis on, you know, our fellowship together, you know, in American Christianity in particular, in the 20th century, a huge amount of emphasis has been put on, do you have the right eschatology? Do you, you know, and in our group, we believe that the rapture happens in the middle of the tribulation, and we don't fellowship with people who believe that it happens at the beginning of the tribulation. And that's not an exaggeration. I mean, that's true. That's out there. So, and that just seems crazy to me. I mean, those questions are difficult enough to sort out what the answers to them are, that I think to be dogmatic on those kinds of issues seems like a real problem to me. It seems to me that at this point, what makes the most sense to me is that the Bible's teaching about the future is intended to have two different sorts of purposes. And for us, at this point in history, as it has been true for most people, what they do is they give us the general assurance. The general picture is there. Jesus is coming back to establish his kingdom, and that is our great hope. And to read that, to be reminded of that over and over again, is a great thing. And that's what all of the teaching about the future, even the book of Revelation, as difficult as it is to sort out, has parts that are very clear about that. The kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. There's no ambiguity about that. That's what's coming. That's what this is ultimately about. So, that sort of encouragement has been for God's people all along. If there is an advantage to knowing any of the specifics, it seems to me that perhaps it will be clear the nature of those specifics and what it is they're about when the events finally come upon us. And if there's a need to know the things that have been revealed there, that we'll have the knowledge of what they're about when they finally happen. That's the way it seems to me right now. Let me just give you an example. Now we're talking about, is there specific information in the Bible that we really need to know? Something about the future that we have been told that is important for us to understand before it happens? Let me just give you the Olivet Discourse as an example. There are two things I would point to there. One of the things in the Olivet Discourse, Jesus talks about this day when, if you find the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, then get out of the city and so forth. That's a warning in advance of something that's going to happen. Is that something that's valuable for us to know? Well, the problem is, at this point, and I know some of you would want to argue with me about that, and that's fine, I'm prepared, but at this point, I would understand what Jesus is teaching in that section to be talking about what happened to Jerusalem when the Roman armies came in and destroyed the temple. That happened in 70 AD. So yes, it was a warning that people needed to heed, but in fact it is a warning that was heeded, as I understand it, and the Christians in Jerusalem did understand. When they saw what was happening, they remembered what Jesus had said, and they got out. So is that some warning that Jesus gave us that we need to understand about what happens in the future? I don't think so. After that, he says this, "Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, 'Behold, he is in the wilderness,' do not go forth. Or 'Behold, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be." Now, I think that statement is something, a warning that we need to take to heart and applies to the future. That what he's saying basically is, I have told you this much about how it's going to happen. I'm not going to come back in secret and meet you in the desert. Somebody comes to you and say, hey, Jesus has come back and we're going to go out in the desert and meet him there and he's going to lead us. If somebody comes and tells you that, don't go with them, because that's not how it's going to happen. My coming back is going to be more like the lightning that flashes across the whole sky. I'm coming everywhere. I mean, I'm taking in the whole thing all at once. My coming is going to be comprehensive. You're not going to have anybody say, let's go find him, because I'm finding you. I mean, that's basically what he's getting at, I think. So that's important for us to know, I think, because there will be a time in the future. I think he's suggesting here, and there are other passages that would suggest the same thing, that there may very well be a time when there will be things that he says that could mislead, if possible, even the elect. Things that would be so striking and convincing that we might go off thinking, yeah, that's it. Let's go do that. And he's warning us in advance, that's not how it's going to happen. So if you see anything like that happening, you already know in advance, it's not me. That's a warning for the future, and it seems to me that that has the potential to be relevant to, at least to the generation upon which those things come. But I don't think that there's an awful lot like that in this teaching about the future. At least so far, as I have understood it so far. I don't think there is much that is important for us to know in advance. That's why we actually have not been given a lot of detail about what's going to happen. So, my answer to the question would be, I think we ought to be people of the Bible. I think we ought to be concerned about the Bible's message. And since the teaching about the end is a part of the Bible's message, I think we ought to be concerned about that. It is not something that we should look down on people who are concerned with. But I think we need to warn each other. There's a lot of foolishness being said about, let me go in and start at the beginning of the book of Daniel. Or, you know, hey, the book of Ezekiel, it's cool. Chapter 38 and 39, big battle, you know, end of the world. But there are like 37 chapters before that. that it might actually be a good idea if we had some idea what they were saying. It might even help us get some idea of what it is he's talking about in the juicy passages. Basically, it seems to me that our call is to be awake and alert, which means that I'm living my life today in the knowledge that my life is not just about the day-to-day grind, the things that are facing me today. The decisions I'm making today are based on what I believe about ultimate reality, about whether there is a God, about whether Jesus is in fact the Christ, whether he is in fact coming. If those things are not true, then I had better not live as if they are true, because I'll be a fool. But if they are true, then I had better not live as if they are not true, because then I will be a fool. And in fact, I'm saying it is true. He is the King, and he is coming back. That means then that I am the servant of this great Master, this great King, and one day I am going to be reporting to him. My entire destiny depends on that meeting, so I had better be ready. That's what Jesus is calling us to. That's what it means to be people who are awake, that we understand what is at stake, and we're living in the light of that. Okay, well, let me give you an opportunity then to correct me, ask me questions, tell me why I'm screwed up to think that the Olivet Discourse is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, or whatever you want.
What if Jesus had said, I'm never coming back, but I'll take you to me? Would we live any different?
No. Well, by take you to me, that...
After death.
After death. When you die, you're going to go to heaven. Not necessarily. The idea is that I understand that my eternal destiny, that I am a person who lives on after death, and that my destiny is dependent on whether I have submitted to the God who made me or not. So, in that sense, no. I do think, though, it is important, somewhat important, to make the distinction. I think, largely, in the Christian community, we have gotten a wrong sort of idea of what our hope is. Haven't you gotten the picture? This is the picture that I got coming into this, is that what happens is one day I'm going to die and I'm going to go to heaven, or else I'm not going to go to heaven. So there's this place where Jesus is, and I'm going to go to heaven. And, of course, we have the picture, you know, it's got clouds, and everybody's dressed in white, and you play harps and have wings and that kind of stuff. And we all know that that's probably sort of a fictitious picture. But we sort of have that idea that the point of this is we're going to die and go to heaven. The reason that it's significant that Jesus is coming back, I think, is because it is tied to the idea that God is going to redeem creation. The fact is that we're not going to live in heaven. That's not the destiny that we're made for. We are going to live in a new heavens and a new earth, as Peter describes it, where righteousness dwells. Going back to Isaiah, talking about God making a new heaven and a new earth. So, in that sense, then, it does change a little bit the picture that I have of what my redemption looks like. I mean, my redemption is not one day I'm going to sit around on clouds and sing hymns all day long, which is kind of the picture that I had. And I know that I wrestled with, and I have met other people who have wrestled with, gee, I know I'm supposed to be excited about sitting around and singing hymns all day long, but sometimes I just have a hard time thinking that, it's almost a cliche that people talk about, you know, hell sounds like a more interesting place to go. But the fact is that that's not the picture. I don't think that's what we've been told. What we stand to enter into is a creation which has been redeemed. so that I, as a creature of God, a human being, will be a redeemed human being, rescued from death, rescued from sin, rescued from corruption. But in the creation that God has created, it was not going to be boring and less to do than what there is now, but it is going to be everything that I see in this creation that seems to have so much potential, the beauty of it and the significance of it and the interesting things to do and learn and all of that, and yet that potential seems to get thwarted so often by death and by our own natures, and we can't get along with each other, and all of that. What we're looking at is the hints that we find in this creation brought to their fruition. That's what I understand the biblical picture to be. So in that sense, the picture of Jesus coming back is one of him coming back to establish his rule over all of creation, which I think it's a picture that I find easier to identify with. So in that sense, I guess it's significant. But you're right. Ultimately, the question is my life about now? Is this it? Are the decisions I'm making now affecting today? And this is all I get? Or are the decisions I'm making today laying the foundation for my destiny, my eternal destiny? And in that sense, then, whether Jesus comes back or just takes me to himself, the issue is the same. So, does that answer your question? Did you have something else in mind?
Well, I mean, I was just curious what you would say if Jesus popped in and said, "Oh, I'm not coming back until after you die." And then he turns to some kid and says, "But I am coming back during your lifetime." It's that same question. What's the difference?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, and the answer that I gave there, it relates to that, because I think that it is interesting that for all believers, the Bible talks about those who have died before Jesus comes back, but even their hope is described not most of the time. Their hope is described in terms of Jesus is going to come back, raise them from the dead, and establish them in his kingdom. That our hope is focused not so much on what happens when I die, but what happens when Jesus comes back. And people debate why it is that's the case, but I think that is the case, that ultimately it is the restored, renewed creation that is my hope. That's the thing that I'm really looking for.
If this is too entailed, just blow it off and I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
But as far as eschatology and hermeneutics and figuring all that out, it seems to me a lot of places in which Jesus quotes the Old Testament, certainly Paul, and for the vast majority of the writers of the New Testament, they take verses out of the Old Testament that, whether you read all 37 previous chapters, you don't know how in the world they got what they got and how they're using it. And so with that, I've always been in a quandary of, okay, these guys use it this way. There really doesn't seem to be any type of rhyme or reason for it. And to just accept the New Testament as authoritative in the way that they've used Old Testament verses, it's like a circular argument. There's no way to establish any type of principles.
Right, right. That's a really good question. Let me just say, the options are the New Testament authors have taken those texts and used them to say things that they never said originally, but they can do that because they're inspired apostles and God gave them permission to take the passages and make them mean something else, which is a tack that some people take. They have taken those passages and used them to say something that they never meant to say, and therefore that's evidence that the New Testament authors really didn't know what they were talking about and we shouldn't be listening to them. Or a possibility is that the New Testament authors, in fact, are not using the Old Testament illegitimately, and that if I go through that process that I described of actually trying to understand in context what the message of the Old Testament passage is, that I will be in a position to understand the point that the New Testament authors were making from the passage. At this point, that's what I'm convinced of. I mean, part of the reason that my view of the Bible entails that if they really were using the Old Testament illegitimately, then I have a real problem, and I would have to rethink a lot. But I don't think they are. Now, some of them are challenging, I admit, to understand what's going on. But the more I have looked at those kinds of examples, the more confidence I get that there is something else going on. There's something, they're doing something with those passages that that actually is quite legitimate. And therefore, in the end, I can't, with impunity, just go and take verses out of context and ignore the context, because they're not doing that either. Now, that's a big claim, but that's what I think. So, but I agree, that's a very significant issue and one that really does need to be addressed.
Okay, this question is totally different from the last one.
Okay.
Let's pretend for a second like I'm 5 years old.
Okay.
And my question is, what happens when we die? And in particular, if you could speak to what is heaven and what about Jesus coming back? So if you could make if you could tell me the truth.
Well.
And speak to a younger mind. Actually, I'm acting like this is my son's question, which it is, but I think I'm like at about a 5-year-old level as well when
right.
it comes to some of this stuff. So right. I'd appreciate it as well.
Okay. Well, let me say something that's not at a 5-year-old level first. I have to preface this. This could get me in lots of trouble because some people have real emotional response to this issue. But at this point, I am not yet sure in my own mind how we should understand the biblical teaching about what happens when I die. Because there are certain things that suggest to me that it's saying, you know, something like, I go to be with Jesus. But there are other things that seem to suggest that in fact what happens is in essence, you know, they talk about being asleep and that sort of thing. The idea that basically God takes me and tucks me away in a little corner of reality, ready to bring me out again when Jesus returns. You know, so that my resurrection from the dead is my return to the stage. I don't know which of those things is true. I'm not confident that I know which of those things is true. If I had to vote right now, I would probably vote for the I go to be with Jesus one. But it's tricky. The problem is the Bible has gone to great lengths to tell me that if I have entrusted my soul to Jesus, that he will not lose it. I mean, that part's very clear. What he does with it in the process, it only kind of hints at various spots, and it's hard to know quite how to put that together. So I think the answer that I would try to give is, God is the one who made me. So when I die, I go back to the one who made me. And I'm not sure what he's going to do with me until Jesus comes back. When Jesus comes back, I'm going to have a new body and I'm going to live in his kingdom forever. Until that time, all I know is that I'm going back to the one who made me and he's going to take good care of me. Something like that, I think, is probably the best I could do. Okay, we sort of... Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying things.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think we're at the end of our time, so I'm going to stop.